Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday. No, it's not. It's Wednesday. And we're going to have great fun and learn so much this hour of the program. Perhaps some of you have already had a chance to see the Nova series, the first part of the series, which was last week, Making Stuff Stronger. Tonight is Making Stuff Smaller, which I watched yesterday in addition to the State of the Union. It was a big day for television. It's a series on our high-tech future and the pioneering breakthroughs of materials science in this four-hour special. And it is put together by a wonderful guy. What a background he has. He has a perfect job when you hear about what he's done for his background. David Pogue is the personal technology columnist for the New York Times. He does a print column, an online column, and an online video, and a daily blog, Pogue's Posts. He is one of the world's best-selling how-to authors. He wrote or co-wrote seven books in the Four Dummies series, including Max Magic, Opera, and Classical Music. He launched his own series of funny computer books called the Missing Manual series. What a terrific idea that was back in 1999. He spent 10 years conducting and arranging Broadway musicals. He won the Ohio Spelling Bee competition in 1977. He's a magician, performing over 400 magic shows during his teen years. And, well, that's just a little bit of who he is. And he does this series, and it's just wonderful. Tonight at on PBS, and it's going to be part number two. It premieres tonight at 8 o'clock, Making Stuff Smaller. And it's just amazing what's going to happen. Particularly, I was struck by what's going to happen in medicine. David is with us this hour. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Hi, David.
Hi, how are you?
I want you to start with a song, really. That would be nice. I want to hear a song, but maybe we can do that later. This is absolutely fascinating material. I had no idea, particularly in the medical realm, how important going small is. It's revolutionary.
Yeah, it's true. The episode tonight focuses on, at the beginning, on the shrinking of everything technological. I mean, if you think about what cell phones looked like when they first came out, they were like, you know, Soviet Army field telephones or these huge,
right,
giant things.
Yeah.
And now the issue is not how small can we make them, but how small can we make them and still have them be usable? You know, at this point, we can make our gadgets smaller, but they might be too small to hold. You know, you need to be able to press the buttons and so on. We went to the Consumer Electronics Show and filmed at the Sony booth my taking a power saw to one of their digital cameras.
Right.
A little tiny thing, size of a deck of cards. And it turns out what's inside is mostly empty space. It's way too big for what it is, but they made it that way, so you have a screen you can look at and buttons you can press. But as you said, the really exciting stuff as things shrink is in medicine, and that's how the show ends, with things like these video cameras that you swallow as a pill that takes a journey down your
amazing
tract and takes two pictures a second and beams them into a little receiver that you have clipped to your belt. And then also these tiny nano robots. These are crazy. We visited this scientist in Switzerland who is working on micro robots. And to the naked eye, it looks like half a splinter. You can only see it when it's
Goodness.
Lying on a piece of paper towel. And, of course, you can't really make something mechanical that size with arms and legs and motors and batteries. So it's really just a tiny, it looks like a pin, a tiny, tiny pin. And then they put around, it's for eye surgery, and they put this thing in your eye, and they control it swimming through the eyeball by putting eight magnets around your head in a helmet, electromagnets. And basically, they can drag this thing through the fluid by controlling the strength of the variously directional magnets. Unbelievable stuff.
Which may allow people to see who couldn't see.
That's exactly right. You can load the tip of this tiny pin with medicine that will unclot a clot at the back of your retina, and then you just drive it to the exact spot where the clot is, and it pricks that spot with the medicine, the clot dissolves, and your vision is restored.
Hmm. And are we going smaller with all of this technology that has profound applications because of new kinds of materials or new designs, or what is it?
Well, yeah, this don't tell anyone, but the series we're talking about, this Making Stuff series, is about the field of science called material science, which nobody's ever heard of, and I'd never heard of it either, by the way, so don't feel bad. It's this relatively new branch. It's a interdisciplinary science between biology and physics and chemistry, and but the people in this field are really fired up because nature has come up with some absolutely incredible materials over the billions of years, just on its own, stuff that our scientists cannot replicate. I mean, we've tried to come up with synthetic this and that that will be better than what's found in nature. But over and over again, we find that the natural stuff, whether it's shark skin or spider silk, is superior in strength and flexibility and durability and so on. So really, the trend now is seeing if we can be inspired by nature, start with the basis of what nature gives us, and then work from there to improve it. And just, I know I'm rambling on, but just one...
No, you're
one
not. Oh, no, you're interesting. Go ahead.
So in the episode next week called Making Stuff Cleaner, we interview a scientist in California who looked at photosynthesis, and he's saying, now, wait a minute, plants take energy from the sun and convert it into fuel and oxygen. I mean, that's what, it's the opposite of global warming. It's taking in carbon dioxide and putting out oxygen. Why aren't we trying to work on that? So he's created artificial photosynthesis, creating tiny leaf-like solar panels, little tiny panels that when the sun hits them, they behave just like leaves. They give off oxygen and electricity. Many times more efficiently than a leaf does.
Oh.
And so if we can scale that up and put that on our roofs or in our gardens or whatever, we've solved a big part of the energy problem and the global warming problem.
Ooh, and could we use that technology for driving cars or for heating and cooling places?
Both indeed. Cars are... the cleaner episode is really interesting because our... nominally I'm the host of this series, but in that particular episode, we stumbled onto this world-renowned car expert who owns one of every kind of car. He has an electric car, he has a hydrogen car, he has a boiler car from the old days. He's got a 1909 electric car. Very few people realize that the original cars were electric and that gas came only later. And this expert's name is Jay Leno.
Oh,
no. The talk show host, he's this huge car nut, and he's kind of our host through that episode. And he points out that, frankly, gasoline is kind of the ideal fuel for cars. I mean, in terms of miles per gallon of energy, we've never found anything like it. The only problem is the pollution. So if we can figure out some way to solve that and keep our gasoline, our internal combustion engines... he's not convinced necessarily that electric's going to be the way or hydrogen's going to be the way, but he supposes that probably it'll become a mix, that for the next many decades we'll have all kinds of cars on the road.
Hmm. Let's go back to the materials that nature has given us, and I'm interested in the discovery process here. And if you would start, please, with this material, I think it's graphene, that was discovered and turns out to be enormously important, and how scientists made it as flat as it could be. And it comes from lead, I guess, and how they discovered it could do what it does.
Yeah, graphene is said to be the strongest material known to man. You can make a layer of this stuff one atom thick.
Wow.
I mean, that's insane—an atom-thick sheet of graphene, and yeah, they basically, you can make it yourself. You put a piece of Scotch tape on a piece of pencil lead, and then graphite, and then peel it up, and you'll see this dark gray layer, and that's basically graphene. And the prospects are very early to predict, but One thing they're saying is that it could be a great replacement for silicon in chips, in computer chips, and make chips smaller, faster, cooler. It turns out a good part of the episode tonight is about computers, because computers are now in everything. They're in our cars, our watches, our cameras, our phones, and the chips inside have sort of reached a limit. You've probably heard of Moore's Law. This guy, Gordon Moore, came up with this this principle in the 1965 that said, I bet that the number of transistors you can pack onto a square inch of chip will double every year. And the implication is that computers will get double powerful every year. And so far, that's held to be true with astonishing regularity. So the computers today are 10 times faster than they were 10 years ago, and so on. I'm doing the math wrong, but you get the idea. It's
right,
exponentially
we got the
faster.
Idea.
But the problem is that is no longer going to hold. So we've actually reached a point where Moore's Law is collapsing. And the reason is the way we keep getting more power out of these chips is by placing the transistors closer and closer together. And now they're getting hotter and hotter, and we're just reaching a limit of size and heat, and we can't keep going this way. So there are some crazy new examples of ways that people are trying to get to the next step, get beyond silicon. Maybe we'll use graphene. At IBM, we interviewed a scientist in her lab who's trying to grow these transistors vertically. So we stack them like skyscrapers. That way we can fit more into the same space where we're now positioning them flat. So all kinds of absolute, and she's doing it. She's growing these things, you know, a fraction of the thickness of a human hair.
Unbelievable.
Tiny stack transistors.
Which you illustrated so beautifully with a pepperoni pizza. Who thought of that?
Your listeners are like, what? Did I just
You'll have to watch it.
She gives the example of, you know, for years we've been making our pepperoni slices on the pizza smaller and smaller and smaller, but after a certain point you can't pack them in any tighter. And then she shows her solution, which is to basically stack the pepperonis as Slim Jims on the pizza, you know, these sticks sticking straight up. It's a good example.
How many people are doing this kind of work, David? Are there laboratories all over the world doing this, or is it highly specialized?
There are. We work closely with the sort of ground zero, grand central of material science, which is an outfit called the Materials Research Society, or MRS. And we, for 2 years running, we attended the MRS convention in Boston, and this year I was a speaker there to introduce the show. And it's so funny, you just walk into this convention center filled with banners saying MRS, and at first I literally thought I was at a bridal conference. Like, you guys got to change your initials. But I think the MRS has tens of thousands of members all around the world.
Huh.
And wow, to go to one of these conferences, it's a mind blow. I mean, you don't understand a word they're saying. You know, the deconfrabulator enters the enzyme modality. You know, you just no idea what they're saying, but you know it's important, and you know they're really smart.
Yeah, well, that's what you love about the series, because you more than most people understand what they're saying, but you allow us to understand what everybody's saying too, which is great, and to be just awestruck by the amazing things that are happening in this world.
Yeah, well, actually, that's kind of a funny point, is that, first of all, Nova, you know, this TV show has been around for decades, and it's a really highly regarded, popular science documentary show, but it's usually not hosted. They usually don't have a guy on camera saying, hi, I'm David Pogue, I'm going to take you into the... So this is a really strange departure for them, and the strangest part of all was me, because I'm not a scientist, and I'd never heard of material science. And also, I'm a very goofy guy. I'm sort of funny on camera. So, and that is definitely not Nova. So somewhere along the line, the producers sort of took a gamble that maybe if they just put a curious, interested person in the center of it, between the viewer and the scientists,
yes,
who could translate, who could, you know, make the scientists feel at ease, and also encourage the scientists not to use jargon on camera. that we might come out with something great. And I think we did.
Yes, we did.
I was reading the Twitter comments as the first episode aired last week, and it was really enheartening. One guy said, "Watch this show and find me one person on earth who would want to defund public broadcasting."
We'll find that on the show so we can use it on the next pledge drive. That's a good idea. David Pogue is our guest. If you haven't seen the series, it does air tonight, the second in the series. It's a four-part Nova series, and David is the host. He does a marvelous job, and it is absolutely fascinating. Tonight's episode, I haven't seen the others. I was watching the State of the Union and doing political research, etc., but I did see tonight's, and it's A-OK, and I will see the rest of these, and the first one, too. There's something. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. You can use an email as well. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for David. Wayne on the road is joining us. Hi, Wayne.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
I missed the very beginning, but I was talking about how nature inspired things and developed things early. Quite a while ago, when they were first looking at the energy efficiency in light bulbs, so filament light bulb, 85% goes off as heat instead of light. And they were looking around and they found lightning bugs were doing cold light. They don't call it cold light anymore, I don't think. But they could replicate the chemicals in that, but it took a lot of years before we got strong enough light-emitting diodes. They basically were nightlight. But the research was motivated by lightning bugs, and I just wanted to add that.
That's fantastic. I love that. Here, another great example is in our fourth and final episode, two Wednesdays from tonight, which is called Smarter, and it's about smart materials. These are materials that actually respond to their environment and change. They can get thicker or harder or stronger. And one of the most amazing stories in this whole series is about shark skin. We interviewed this oceanographer at the University of Florida who discovered that nothing grows on sharks. They don't have barnacles or algae or anything.
Huh.
And when he inspected them under the electron microscope, he discovered why, that there's a tiny, tiny, tiny pattern of ridges on shark skin. I mean, way too small to see with your eye. And it's the little walls created by these patterns are too narrow for anything to stick to. So he thought, wait a minute, what if I adapt this pattern that nature came up with and shrunk it down so that it's so small that bacteria cannot grow on it? And he's developed this plastic sheet, clear plastic. It looks just like clear plastic, but it actually is imprinted with this shark pattern, very, very tiny ridged walls in diamond patterns, that when they discovered that bacteria can't fit inside the ridges. One cell can get in there, but then it sends out this chemical signal to all the other bacteria that says, hey, there's no room for a colony here. Go somewhere else. And he's going to market this to hospitals where, you know, infections are a huge, huge problem.
Oh.
We've been trying to kill off the deadly bacteria and diseases in hospitals through chemicals, trying to kill them, but you can never kill more than 99%, and of course you leave the last 1%, the strongest ones, which reproduce and develop resistant strains and so on. So he's going to roll this stuff out on, you know, door handles and light switches and bed rails and trachea tubes, and instead of trying to kill all the bacteria, this stuff just makes it go somewhere else. It's absolutely brilliant. And again, we got the idea by looking at the sharks.
Look at that world around us. And the one tonight, this could have profound ramifications for people who have cancer, the bee venom. Can you talk about that part of the piece tonight?
Yeah, that's a mind blower, too.
It is.
It turns out that bee venom is a fantastic anti-cancer drug. I mean, it just kills cancer cells dead. So if we could just figure out a way to dust the cancer cells with bee venom, you'd be cured of cancer. But how do you do that? How do you get inside the body, which is vast and the cells are tiny? And, you know, so what he's done is he's created what he calls nano bees.
Oh my.
He takes nanoparticles of bee venom and he coats them with a couple of different layers of other chemicals, one which is designed to hunt down and bond with the cancer cells in your body but leave the healthy cells alone, and then another coating which, once it's there, helps the thing erupt and explode right into the cancer cell and delivering the drug. And apparently it really works. They're, you know, testing on animals and so on, but apparently the bees might help us lick cancer.
Is it? And he said it was, what, maybe a year away they'll start testing on humans?
That's right. It's really
wow.
Exciting.
That is exciting. Wayne, thanks for the call. Jim is next from Pulaski. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Kathy. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
But I think your guest just answered my question. I was hoping he would talk about nanomedicine specifically, and I have a personal interest in it because my wife was diagnosed with cancer about 2 months ago.
Hmm.
We've been going through all the surgery, all the chemo, and I've read a lot about nanomedicine, and I'm wondering when we're actually going to really, when this can be applied, and I know it's a little bit different, I think, than what your guest was talking about, but I'm wondering if you would know more about that and how nanomedicine will be able to eliminate cancer once and for all, and along with a lot of other deadly diseases and problems that we've got.
Sure. That's a really important issue. So nanotechnology, we hear that word all the time, but what it means is when you get particles of a material that are so small, I mean, much, much, much smaller than you can see even with a microscope, their properties are different than what we know from their large-scale versions. So, for example, we went to the Canterbury Cathedral in England and looked at the stained glass windows there. They've been using nanotechnology for 1,000 years. They would grind up gold into tiny, tiny particles to make the red pieces of glass. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Why would gold make red? Well, it turns out that when you carve down gold into small enough particles, it's actually red. Again, and silver becomes blue. It's crazy, but that's what nanotechnology is. So by making our medicines and testing equipment that small, we can achieve things in the body that we could never achieve with larger scale gadgets, even cells or dust or powder. We're talking about many, many, many times smaller than that. So right now we're just at the very dawn of this. Right now we're still just cataloging the potential. We're not really doing a lot with it yet. It's hard, right, because you can't really see the stuff. You can't even – you sort of have to use measuring systems that imply the existence of these materials. But, for example, one guy we interviewed is doing fantastic work with using nanotechnology – as a diagnostic tool. So he can put a drop of your blood on these nanoparticles which clump to it or react to it in ways that when there's enough billions of them you can measure and then know right away what kind of cancer, how strong it is, and so on. In fact, the hope is that you can get 70 different tests all on the same slide from using these nanoparticles as your indicators. So we're just at the beginning of it, but because it's a whole new world of behavior of these materials, there's incredible potential.
Hmm. I found that Canterbury part of the show really fascinating. And I was thinking about the people who were probably just sitting around hundreds and hundreds of years ago playing around with stuff, right? To playing around with gold to find out that it could be pink or it could be red, or it just came from people experimenting, didn't it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it's a dying art. We also visited the last glass-making factory in the UK that can still make glass that old way. It's an amazing, complicated, multi-step process. I mean, really, it's like 15 steps to get this glass the right color and the right thickness and the right durability to last 1,000 years. And you watch these guys do it and you're like, who came up with this? How many billions of experiments did they do to come up with this one sequence?
Here's an email that's come in from Donna in Middleton. I would like to thank David for making his TV series so exciting. The Nova series is a highlight for my daughter, age 8, and my son, age 13. Thank you for bringing such an educational series into our home. It was also interesting to learn about David's uncle at MIT. I don't know that story.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for your wonderful email. I'm the one who should be thanking the world because this is an unbelievable experience. They wanted it to be very experiential. They didn't want me just walking into labs and talking to scientists. They wanted me to live the science. So I went hang gliding. I swam with sharks. I landed on an aircraft carrier. I fired an AK-47. I wasn't sure if they wanted to film me or kill me, but it was thrilling, just one adventure after another. But one of the adventures, yes, was visiting the lab of my great uncle Harold Edgerton, who is a beloved and famous scientist. He developed the strobe light, you know, the camera flash, and he became famous for high speed photography. You know that famous picture of the bullet going through the apple, or the drop of milk splashing on a plate, and it looks like a white crown splashing up. Those are his photos. And he became the master back in the 50s and 60s of stopping time with his strobe light. And we actually went to his lab at MIT, which is still there and still preserved and still an active lab. And we filmed there using his original equipment to stop time as we fired bullets through different materials to test their properties. And Uncle Harold himself was once the subject of a Nova episode.
Oh, my.
So it was this huge, coming of age, big circle closing family thing. It really felt great.
You went all over the world for this. I didn't know you had all those adventures, too.
Oh, yeah.
What a great job.
I was away a lot. I feel bad for my kids, but I did finally return home and remember how many I had, and a great reunion.
And I'm sure you got their heads thinking about their adventures, huh?
Yeah. You know, the greatest thing was last Wednesday for the premiere, we rented, or Nova was nice enough to rent a beautiful auditorium in New York City to have a tweet-up. That is an invitational thing on Twitter where I said, hey, we're going to show the premiere of this series on a big screen with a great sound system, and I'm going to give a talk beforehand showing behind-the-scenes photos, and anyone who wants to can just come. So it was fantastic.
Oh,
about 150 people came, and
nice.
Of course my family came, and my agents and my sister, and it was really funny. It was like a this is your life moment.
Right, very nice. Let's go to Ben in Oconomowoc. Hi, Ben.
Good morning. I wanted to weigh in on the conversation, saying that I think the do-it-yourself movement is really having quite a large influence on technology right now. There's a lot of people that they're actually getting together and forming groups called hacker spaces or maker spaces to get together and share tools, work on projects. And we actually have one in Milwaukee called the Milwaukee Makerspace. And it's a membership-driven group that meets at a physical location with equipment ranging from plasma cutters and welders to electronics to woodworking equipment. And members have been doing everything from building electric cars to wooden boats to electronics to a coffee pot that you can fire up from your iPhone as you drive there, and then it'll keep track of how much coffee you drink. Just a lot of neat things like that. If people are interested in finding out about that, they can at milwaukeemakerspace.org.
Okay.
And then I also wanted to mention a website that I enjoy called instructables.com, which is a place that people can, when they make a project, they can take photos and tell how they did it and post it on a website like that. And it's just amazing how technology is being shared and being very inspirational. And actually, on Instructables.com, I just won their big contest sponsored by Sears by building my own plug-in hybrid car. So kind of a poor man's Chevy Volt. But it's just really impressive the kind of projects that people are getting together and working on. And I think it's really influencing mainstream technology.
How many are there of you, and how often do you meet, Dan or Ben?
Members actually have 24-hour access to the makerspace, and we meet on Tuesday evenings at 7 o'clock to discuss how we can promote do-it-yourself technology. It's open to the public Tuesday and Thursday nights for both the meetings and little electronics get-togethers, little workshops. Learn how to solder and that sort of thing.
This is wonderful. You must be somewhat familiar with these, David, huh?
Are
you?
Yeah, I mean, I know a plug when I hear one. But on the other hand, I could not agree more about this maker movement. It's probably the best known example of these guys getting together is the Maker Faires, spelled with an E on the end, held in New York and San Francisco each year. And they're getting to be huge. I mean, we're talking about 50,000 attendees and acres of hobbyists. I mean, it's hard to describe until you see it, which, by the way, you can do by going to YouTube and typing in Maker Faire. You'll see some it's just people inventing in their garages, basically, and they cannibalize transistor radios and Legos and camcorders and reassemble them in new ways and share information, as your caller said, on the web. And first of all, obviously, it's fun for both the creator and for the audiences who go to see these things. But second of all, it's a resurgence. It's a grassroots resurgence of innovation, invention, creative thinking, and building things with your hands. I mean, we were losing that, right? Who could fix their car anymore when it's all a big computer? You know, I mean, even regular mechanics would have a hard time figuring out what's wrong with a Prius or something. So the resurgence of making things with your hands, inventing things, wiring things together, experimentation, I do not think could be much more exciting.
Thanks, Ben, for the call. Dan in Three Lakes. Hi. Hello, Dan.
Hello.
Hi, Dan. Go ahead.
I just thought I'd mention that unlike things that have to be dreamed up yet, for at least four decades, the big three automakers in this country have always been making cars that run on LP gas, the same stuff you burn in your gas grill. The equipment for purchasing refills of this stuff is all over the country. Every Menards, every Home Depot, every Fleet Farm sells gas bottles. And it's the oil companies that have prevented these cars from being sold to the general public. They're only available to fleet operators. And we've just heard an announcement within the last couple of weeks that we've discovered in this country multiple times the gas supplies that we ever knew about. If we would put more of these gas cars on the road, it's a heck of a lot cheaper. The mileage is just as good. Resupplies are everywhere. And it's about time we got behind that. And if you have never watched the documentary, Who Killed the Electric Car, you really ought to do that. Because the problem with them, California forced the production of electric cars, but they would never be sold. They were only leased. So Chevrolet, Ford, and Oldsmobile, I think, produced them. General Motors produced them, and Ford. I don't know if Chrysler ever did. But the problem was the battery. Well, a gentleman in Detroit invented a battery that was multiple times better than the ones that they had, the lead-acid batteries. And ExxonMobil bought the patent and stifled production of those batteries.
David.
Yes.
Do you look at energy in the series?
Yeah, next week's episode is called Cleaner, and it is about energy. It's a tough problem. And on these electric cars, by the way, I did enjoy Who Killed the Electric Car, but I have to underline one part of that story that the filmmaker did not underline, and that is that electric cars are massively expensive to build. I had the opportunity of interviewing Bob Lutz, who oversaw the electric car, GM's big product development guy, and he told me that those EV1s that they released in California cost basically $1 million each, which is why they were never sold. Nobody would ever buy one. The descendant, of course, the Chevy Volt, which is just about to come out, which I got to test drive, will be for sale. It's $40,000, still steep. But it'll go down over time. The early adopters will pay the highest price, and it'll go down later. And I really do believe that they're trying to do the right thing. Maybe only because the public has forced them. Right, the public is now demanding cleaner cars and electrics. So that's a welcome development. And I would be willing to say if there's a future in natural gas cars, the public's interest will overwhelm the lobbyists and the oil industry propagandists, because really the bottom line is, can we sell cars, not are we pleasing the oil industry? So that's the exciting thing about right now, is right now the public wants cleaner cars, and the car companies, like slow, elderly, conservative grandparents, are gradually coming around.
Hmm. It seems to me as though, you know, one year we want them, and then the gas prices go down, and so we don't think about it, and then the gas prices go up, so we think that we want it. It seems to me as though we've been on a roller coaster with this for quite a few years.
That is absolutely correct. It's very, very disheartening that we want the electrics and the Priuses when gas prices are high, and when gas prices go down, we're back to gas. But overall, I would say the macro trend, the larger, if you had to graph it, despite all these smaller spikes, the larger trend is toward more fuel-efficient cars, fewer emissions, and that is what the public wants.
Thanks, Dan. Jean in Wauwatosa. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
All right, Jean. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Good.
A couple things I've been thinking. I've been making my Pinewood Derby car for Cub Scouts. So I'm making something smaller. But my connection is both your shows this morning. This is the kind of thing that President Obama was talking about when we need, when he said we want people to be, kids especially, to be as excited about winning the science fair as about going to the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
I know, as a Bears fan, he had a double-edged comment on the Super Bowl part, but giving a shout out to the Packers. But I'm recording your series, so thanks very much for your awesome shows, Kathleen.
Thanks, Jean. And this is what happens with your series, is that you do get people as excited about all this. I don't think this is real common knowledge, all that's happening in the medical field and in the energy field. It's very exciting.
Yeah, it really is. And by the way, the shows, I mean, it's PBS, so there's no commercials. It is gorgeously filmed. We're talking about high definition, beautifully edited, and it's all available for free online at any time. So if you miss it, no big deal. At pbs.org, you can watch every episode that's been aired so far. Well, one tonight, two. And there's a. By the way, the show itself. Speaking of the Obama administration, the show itself is largely funded by the National Science Foundation and the Department of Energy, by the government, which is so encouraging. You know, the government is understanding the importance of science and technology. That is this country's innovative edge, and they're supporting it to make shows like this. So part of the show's budget is a huge outreach program, educational kits for science teachers and schools, and experiments for kids to conduct on their own. And also, it's worth noting that as we went around and interviewed these scientists, one after another told us that this is a great time to be in science, because this government administration is pro-science, supports their efforts, tries to make funds available for experiments and research, which, you know, previous administrations were perhaps not. And this is not a political statement. This is not a political statement. I'm just saying that for whatever other factors are at play, the current administration is fostering a great deal of fantastic, helpful science that will lead us, make us leaders in energy and health and so on in the next few years.
Hmm. Thanks, Jean, unless you had something more. Jean is gone. Thanks, Jean, for your call. Our guest this hour is David Pogue. He is the host of the wonderful Nova Making Stuff series. Number two in the series, there are four, is tonight. And you can also get it if you go to pbs.org. He said they're all available online, or at least today's would be. David is the personal technology columnist for the New York Times, and he is a tech correspondent for CBS News. He appears on CNBC with his comic tech videos. He has written so many of those books in the series For Dummies. He also is an arranger and a conductor. He has done several Broadway musicals, well, more than several. He spent 10 years conducting and arranging Broadway musicals. So he's quite a guy. And he traveled all over the world for this series and got to participate in quite a few adventures himself. I'm Kathleen Dunn. More phone calls in a moment at 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Sharon. Hi, Sharon.
Good morning.
Hi.
What a fascinating show. Three things. One, my cousin works with the Einstein Project, which is the science projects that schools can subscribe to and get them, and the kids do the stuff, and then they send them back, and they get new ones. It's a great science, and it's national. It came out of the Smithsonian originally. Mm. My question is this. We have so much waste product in our world, floating in the ocean and wherever. I understand we already have some algae that are going to eat the oil spills, but what about how do we get rid of the rubble in Haiti? Is there anything we can do with it? Is there any machine that'll grind it up? Can they add to their coastline? Are you thinking about these kinds of things?
Wow. Well, I'm at a total blank on that one. I not something I've studied, not something I would know, but I could not agree with you more about the waste issue. 2 weeks ago, I was asked to write a column for the New York Times Sunday Magazine just about my area, which is the electronics industry. Is there any hope in stopping this rampant consumerism disposability issue of our gadgets? We get a new phone every 2 years, a new camera every 2 years, and then we basically throw them into the landfill. And I did a lot of research and a lot of studying, and the only solution I could find is for the public to start caring enough. Because it is true that when the public cares, things change. You know, whether it's going to organic milk or cutting back on fuel, you know, emissions from cars. And when the public cares and makes it a marketing point, companies do change, but that's the one hope we have. So thank you for articulating the concern.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sharon, for the call. I want to go back to that camera because I keep thinking about it. The young girl who had some kind of intestinal disorder, this camera and the other uses for it that is so small that she swallowed it like a pill, and then we could see the picture of the camera was taking picture of her intestines. Is that being used widely, and how else might that be used? It was just amazing to me, David.
Yeah, it is very widely used, the pill cam. And what's happened over the last few years is that they've gotten much smaller and much better and much higher quality. So when you play back the video from the little belt pack that you wear, it actually looks, you know, looks like a video of a tunnel going through your system. And this is a little gross, but it's one of my favorite aspects of the whole story. The doctor we interviewed told us that you are told that, you know, at the other end of the pill's journey, it's okay to just flush it away. You don't need to worry about it. But you would be surprised at the number of times they get the video and they see, after it exits, they see a hand reaching into the toilet.
Oh, my gosh.
See it walking over to the sink and water and soap, and people want to keep it as a souvenir, I guess.
Yeah, well, I could see why. Oh, my goodness.
It's all there on the video.
Let's go to Thomas from Kenosha. Hi, Thomas.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Pretty good.
Good.
Yeah, the reason why I was calling, you were talking about Obama, how he wants to change everything on the energy thing. Over the last 8 years, I designed a system for semi-trucks that gets 18 miles per gallon by reorganizing the fuel into a pure form of energy. And currently, semis get 6 miles per gallon. So, I mean, you can see how that would change the economy.
Is that all
shipping,
they get?
Shipping prices go.
6 miles a gallon. Ooh.
But wow. Anyway, I sent it to every government agency there was, and they kept leading me around in circles. I mean, it was ridiculous. And I've been going over this for the last year, and I haven't got any response from anyone. And it's kind of disheartening when you got something that's going to change everything, and no one's really interested in it.
So, but why are you sending it to the government? Why wouldn't you send it to the manufacturers who would exploit it?
Actually, I did send it to the manufacturers, and they didn't seem to be interested in it either. I sent it to Kenworth, Peterbilt, Volvo, you name it, every truck company there was. You think they'd want to do something. I mean, that'd increase production, everything, you know. I mean, you take it right now, you're paying $3.30 a gallon. With my system, it costs you $1.10 every 6 miles. With their system, it costs you $3.30 every 6 miles. I mean, right now, that's why all the costs of goods are so high, because of shipping.
Exactly.
And it's, like I said, it's kind of disheartening when you got something that could change everything and get the economy going again, and no one seems to be interested in it.
Well, maybe this phone call will be the thing that turns it around. How can any listeners who have contacts get in touch with you?
I can give you my phone number and my email address.
Why don't you do email? I don't think you want to give your phone number over the air.
Okay. All right. Email address is MOUZES.
M-L?
Yeah, M-O-U.
M-O-U.
Z as in zebra.
Uh-huh.
E-S.
Okay.
Enterprise at yahoo.com.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's hope that generates some interest. Sounds like a great invention.
Okay.
And remember, David, when you become a millionaire, right, David?
That's right. Cut me in for 1%.
Right. You started the whole thing. Thanks, Thomas, for the call. Jane in Middleton. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. I am so excited to hear about all this technology because it makes me hopeful that my one little pet peeve will someday be invented. And what I want is a full-size cordless vacuum cleaner that I don't have to be tripping over the cord all the time.
You'd think we'd have that by now, wouldn't you, David?
There isn't a full-size cordless vacuum cleaner?
Yeah, that keeps its power. You know, you have the little ones.
Yeah.
But I want a full-size one. Like, I love my vacuum cleaner, except, you know, it's a bagless one and all of that. But it has this cord, and I'm always tripping over the cord, and I just hate that.
Well, that's actually a really brilliant idea, and if that doesn't exist, then, oh, my God, it should. And
yes.
I'm sure the reason that it doesn't is because battery technology has not really progressed very far in the last 20 years. It's just little incremental changes. But in the last year, especially with the advent of electric cars, they've really had to do some amazing battery work. We look at this in the next week's show. And I'll bet you there is now technology, lithium ion or whatever comes next, that could work in a vacuum. So now I'm going to be a millionaire twice over.
Yeah, thanks very much, Jane. I love my vacuum cleaner, too. I kind of like to vacuum. I like that. I like to see the dirt go into it. All right. Jane, thank you. Christian is next in Oshkosh. Hi, Christian.
Hi. My favorite recent maker story is this guy who built a wind-powered cart that'll go downwind, straight downwind, faster than the wind. It's, you know, known that ice boats and sailboats can tack downwind faster than the wind, and he posed a little mind-bender conundrum on a web forum. You know, can you build a cart of some kind that could go straight downwind without having to zigzag? And it unleashed the most monumental kind of back and forth flame war between people calling each other, you know, proponents of perpetual motion and calling each other idiots. And so he actually went and built the thing full size. Tested it out in Mojave, you know, at the, you know, the wind-powered, official sanctioned, you know, the whole thing. And so, you know, there was really no other way to settle the story. I mean, all the other theoretical things just caused more arguments and more flame wars, so he just built it. That was a wonderful story.
Yeah.
Fantastic. There's just nothing more exciting than invention.
Right. Thank you very much for the call. Well, we're almost out of time. Give us, in 45 seconds, we talked about tonight, what are the next two in the series, David?
Yeah, so the remaining episodes are Cleaner, Smaller, and Smarter.
Mm.
And Cleaner looks at energy and power and emissions. Smaller looks at nanotechnology and technology itself getting smaller and smaller. And smarter is the mind-blowing one with shark skin and airplanes whose wings can bend and crazy, crazy, amazing stuff.
Oh, sounds fabulous. Well, thank you so much. You're just delightful and so enthusiastic about this. You've performed a great public service, don't you think?
I think so. I'm the honored one to have been involved on this project. It truly is amazing TV made for all the right reasons that really hits it out of the park, in my opinion.
Yeah, it does. Thanks, David.
Thanks for the time.
David Pogue, personal technology columnist for the New York Times. He is host of the Making Stuff series on PBS, and the second in the series is tonight, which is Making Stuff Smaller, and well worth your time and your eyes and your ears. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production, and thanks for all of your interesting calls, everybody, all morning. They were good. I'm Kathleen Dunn. I have a furlough day tomorrow, so I won't be with you until Monday when we will do all things political. Once again, great conversations ahead on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.